Live-action movies based on animated series can be a tough challenge. Now imagine taking an animated series that initially appeared on MTV's Liquid Television, a series that made you seriously wonder how good the drugs were back in the 90s. Add in a heaping pile of studio interference and watch the degree of difficulty rise. Time to dive in and see if 2005's Aeon Flux is not that bad. Welcome, welcome, one and all to It's Not That Bad, the podcast that looks for A grades in B movies and a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Now, I have a little bit of insider information for those of you who like to listen to podcasts. When you're trying to make sure that you have things scheduled, occasionally you like to plan episodes out. You like to make sure that you're on a schedule. And we try to do that. We don't always succeed. Let's be honest. We kind of fly by the seat of our pants. But there was a time when we really honestly tried to say, okay, we're going to have all these movies and put them in a row, and that's what we're going to do. One of those movies we picked, and it's been a bit, but we finally got around to doing it, and that is Aeon Flux. And here to finally join me for this journey is my lovely wife, Carrie. Carrie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Aw, this is your Mordecai.
This is my Mordecai. So let me explain. When we were in the earlier, more embryonic days of the podcast, we actually had like a bag with a bunch of actors' names, and we would occasionally pull one out and say, oh, okay, so here's the actor. Let's pick a movie from their filmography. So that way we're not just sitting there just randomly picking all of our favorite movies occasionally with like a challenge. Many, many moons ago, we picked Charlize Theron's name out of the bag, and Aeon Flux was, of course, a good movie to choose for that. That was about a year and a half ago when we finally pulled her name and chose that film. A year and a half, we have had Aeon Flux written on the whiteboard in my office. A year and a half that we have avoided this movie like the plague.
I think it's permanently burnt into the whiteboard.
Like, I think so.
Like, I don't think you'll actually ever be able to delete it.
Oh, there's a trick. There's a trick. There's actually a hack for that. And you know, before we get into the movie, dear listeners, if you've ever had that moment where you accidentally grabbed the permanent marker, the Sharpie to use on your whiteboard, just go over what you wrote with a real dry erase marker, and it will get rid of the Sharpie. Yeah, welcome, everybody. But this is one of those situations where I may have to do that with dry erase marker on top of dry erase marker.
He's handsome and he's handy.
Right?
You're a keeper.
Well, the women don't find you handsome. They may as well find you handy. But yeah, Aeon Flux. And I'm, you know me, I'm a sci-fi geek. This was a first watch for me. This was a very first watch for me. I mean, I remember when the animated series came out and I caught an episode like here or there kind of thing. And it's like, it was never really in my lexicon. So to you, Carrie, I ask you, prior to this movie, did you have any idea of the existence of this animated series?
Nope. See, I'm gonna put it out on Front Street here. I didn't even know until today that there was an animated series. Like, I'm today years old finding that out. And I mean, Aeon Flux was always just kind of like
there,
the Mordecai. That was the ongoing joke. I was like, I'm sure that movie doesn't even exist. Well, yeah, we'll never get around to it, so I don't have to worry about it. Things keep coming up.
There's this mythical movie out there that we have yet to watch. And
It was the Snuffleupagus of movies. But no, it was definitely a first watch for me too. And completely going into it green. Like, had no idea what I was getting into. No idea what was going on. But more on that later.
But yeah, so dear fans of the Aeon Flux franchise, do know that we are approaching this movie from a complete and utter noob standpoint. So really, like, if I caught a full episode, it was very, very rare. So I had no idea the full story of it. All I know is like late 90s MTV or early to mid 90s or whatever it was, MTV era type cartoon. Liquid Television was also like the original home of like Beavis and Butthead. So that kind of gives you an idea of where that was going on.
Is it based at all in literature, in comic book form?
Not
in
that I know
novel?
Of.
Novel?
Yeah, like I will be honest, I'm a complete and utter Aeon Flux idiot. I have no idea. All I know is that there was a show, there were shorts, and then there was a movie with Charlize Theron. That's pretty much my my understanding of the Aeon Flux history.
Good, me too. And I've watched the movie, and I'm still, like, I don't know what the f*** going on.
We're going to do our best here, people. We're going to do our best.
I was hoping that there would be a book or some kind of a guide to Aeon Flux.
Dear listeners, please send all Aeon Flux correspondence to my lovely wife, Carrie, on social media at Not That Badcast. I will pass along all the information and force her to read everything afterwards.
Help. Help me.
Well, before we give this the college try, before we go down this road, it is time to take the cinematic version of Aeon Flux and trailerize it.
It is the year 2415, and humanity has walled itself off from the rest of the world in order to protect itself, which I already do. So what else is new? But not everyone is happy living in a world run by scientists. Enter Aeon Flux, a badass one-woman killing machine. She set out on a quest to kill the leader of this utopian dystopia so everyone can be free. Well, at least that's what the creepy woman in her head tells her. But when given the chance, her target calls her a different name, and that somehow works. I mean, call me crazy, but I thought calling a woman by someone else's name would instantly put you in danger of being killed. Man, the future is backwards. Along the way, she'll backflip, front flip, and generally acrobatics routine her way around every bullet blasted her way in a quest to find the truth behind it all, or at least a plot. One of the two. Charlize Theron is Aeon Flux, rated PG-13 for propensity of gymnastics.
I might have broken Carrie during the reading of that.
I still have tears.
Every now and then we have to actually pause the trailerize during recording so Carrie can have a good little bit of a laughing fit. This was one of those times.
It was the whole calling a woman by another name.
Yeah, I'm pretty darn skippy. Pretty darn skippy if, you know, while you're trying to kill me and I'm like, Samantha. And you're like, who? I'm dead. I'm dead at that point. Now, not this, you're going to stop killing me. You're going to pull the trigger faster. That's pretty much what would happen. Yeah, not going to happen. All right, let's get into who is in this movie. The movie stars Charlize Theron, Martin Saukas, Johnny Lee Miller, Sophie Okonedo, Pete Postlethwaite, Amelia Warner, Carolyn Chakezi, and Frances McDormand. And if I messed up any of those names, I am so sorry. I apologize. I'm just an idiot in a basement with a microphone.
I'm actually shocked. I didn't know there were that many
people in
characters.
I know, right?
It kind of felt like it was
Aeon Flux and everybody else.
And the two dudes that were working together, he had an assistant.
Yeah, we'll get there. We'll get there.
Who else?
So don't worry, we'll get there. But there is an almost starring in this. In the role of Aeon Flux, and I'm going to toss these three names at you, Karen. I want to get your opinion on each of these, okay? The first one is Michelle Rodriguez.
Ooh.
She would have been badass in this.
The
thing is, I don't think Michelle Rodriguez had the animated series look. I mean, I will give Charlize Theron full kudos. Aside from the crazy hair in the animated series, Charlize Theron had the look of Aeon Flux. Michelle Rodriguez, maybe not so much.
Her hair was on point, though.
Oh, completely on point.
So does that match the animated
color, yes, but the her hair in the animated series is much more out there. But I mean, it's like an more anime series. Yeah, like, exactly. Yeah.
Like sticking out and up. Kind of like Vanilla Ice bangs.
If you're comparing Aeon Flux to Vanilla Ice, then we have gone way off the tracks and just proven how little we know about Aeon Flux.
I'm just trying to understand.
How would I put it? Almost more like kind of like a greaser pompadour kind of thing, but to the extreme.
Okay.
Cool. And yes, I said to the extreme after you made your Vanilla Ice reference. So,
but if there's a problem, yo,
we'll solve it.
Aeon Flux will solve it.
I'm going to check my rock card at the door right now. All right. Demi Moore.
Wouldn't she be a bit... Well, okay, 2005.
2005, Demi Moore.
Still a bit old, I think.
And Nicole Kidman.
No, but I'm going to match you on this one, and I'm going to say Halle Berry.
Maybe, but I'm going to see your Halle Berry and see you a Kate Beckinsale. I think she would have been really, really good in this. Of course, Kate Beckinsale was also juggling the Underworld series, so...
How about Uma Thurman?
Uma Thurman could have been really good, too.
Like, kind of like a Kill Bill kind of vibe.
But yeah, but I
only cooler.
Charlize Theron, I think, really matched the tone and the tonality that they were going for.
I think she was great. I think she was a great choice.
Oh, absolutely, like,
I wouldn't recast her.
But Michelle Rodriguez definitely is up there as a possibility, for sure.
That would be fantastic, yeah.
The movie was directed by Karen Kusama. And, of course, keep in mind, this is only her second film. Since then, she's also directed Jennifer's Body and Destroyer. However, there's an almost directed by, and that is Darren Aronofsky, also known for Requiem for a Dream, The Wrestler, Black Swan, and The Whale. But with that said, I wonder if Darren Aronofsky had actually directed this, if it would have been too out there, maybe not more focused on the action as opposed to the style.
Could it have been more out there? I mean, it was pretty out there.
Out there, yes. But the thing is, I think Karen Kusama actually added a lot more focus on the action, maybe, possibly. We're going to get to the pacing of this movie a little bit later. But Darren Aronofsky apparently was considered to direct this film. I don't know if it would have worked, but maybe. Luc Besson, maybe, who, of course, directed The Fifth Element and Valerian. I think he would have done a phenomenal job with this, but this is just me kind of... fan directing or fan casting your director. At the box office, this film had a budget of $62 million. Domestically, it only made $25.8 million and worldwide only $53 million. So a money loser. But when it debuted on the December 2nd, 2005 weekend, it only debuted at number two. Number one that week was Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire in its third week. Aeon Flux debuted with 12.6 million. Harry Potter had 19.8 million. Also in theaters in the top five, number three was Walk the Line. Number four was Yours, Mine, and Ours. And number five was Just Friends. Believe it or not, there are actually some awards for this film. Good and bad. At the 2006 Scream Awards, it was nominated for Best Sci-Fi Film, lost to V for Vendetta. And you know what? V for Vendetta is pretty freaking awesome. Yeah, I see no fault. I see no fault. But then there's the awards on the other side. At the 2006 Golden Trailer Awards, this was nominated for the Golden Fleece Award. Now, let me explain. The Golden Fleece Award is the award for the trailer that makes a bad movie look good. Lost to Into the Blue. And at the 2005 Stinkers Bad Movie Awards, the movie received a dishonorable mention, so it was in the list of films that were considered but didn't even make the top five. Charlize Theron was nominated for Worst Actress. She lost to Tara Reid for Alone in the Dark. And Johnny Lee Miller was nominated for Worst Supporting Actor for this and Mindhunters, lost to Tyler Perry for The Diary of a Mad Black Woman. Now, the reason why we are here, and not just because that we've been sitting on this film for a year and a half and avoiding it. Eventually, you have to pull the thorn out of the foot. You have to get the rock out of the shoe. You have to put the Band-Aid on the paper cut. It's kind of what this movie was to us. But it's the critics. At Metacritic, this film has a Metascore of 36. And at Rotten Tomatoes, it had an audience score of 39% and a tomatometer of 9.
Ooh.
Yeah, 9.
That's harsh.
So if we're going by the mission statement of our lovely little podcast here, our goal is to prove to you that Aeon Flux is better than a 9% movie. So
it's not that bad.
So before we even get to talking about this film itself, Carrie, if I were to say to you that a movie had a 9% critic score, what kind of movie are you expecting? At least what's the general census of like your walk away feeling from it?
For the most part, that would be criteria for one of my favorite movies. I tend to go with the underdog, and I do feel that 9 is, that's harsh.
It is harsh.
That, I mean, audience was sitting at 39.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fair. Yeah, I would say, yeah, it's around a 40. I mean, it wasn't bad.
It was horrible.
I mean, she played the part well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a 9%, like anything in between like 0 and 5%, like in that really, really bottom tier, it, to me, that's the kind of movie where you have to kind of have that Clockwork Orange kind of moment where you're strapped to the chair with your eyelids being held open so you can finish watching the movie. That, to me, is a 0 to 5% film. This at 9%, like, 9% to me is like, okay, well, maybe we haven't got you strapped in, but you're definitely not allowed to leave. It's like you're grounded and you can only leave the room after watching that movie.
Yeah, it wasn't like that. Yeah, I didn't watch it under duress. I didn't know what was going on. I was trying to figure out, what was happening. But even at that, it all made sense in the end.
In the end,
getting
yeah.
there. Getting there was tough.
It's a bit of a round trip, yeah.
But no, it was not a 9.
No.
It's not that bad.
Well, let's get into this film. And we're going to start, of course, with Charlize Theron herself, who played Aeon Flux. How was she for you?
I mean, she was great. She was absolutely great. Athletic and believable. And it was interesting because there were almost like, two versions of her. Can I say that? I don't know. Watch the movie and then you'll know what I'm talking about. But it was almost like she had to play two different parts or multiple personalities.
Yeah. Like we're going to do our best to not really spoil the film because, you know, there is something to be said about, you know, discovering things for yourself. So just know that there is a current version and a past version of Aeon Flux in this film. And that's all we're going to say about the plot point at that point. But I mean, let's get into this, right? Like Charlize Theron, this is actually one of her first action movies. And prior to this, of course, she was in Monster and got a lot of critical acclaim for this. So at this point, Charlize Theron is a known commodity as far as movie going audiences go. And the amount of praise that she got for Monster probably led a lot of people sit there going, okay, you're doing these really big dramatic roles and you know, you handle changing yourself into these different people and you become unrecognizable on camera and all of a sudden you choose to do this obscure, puffy action kind of sci-fi flick that doesn't really, it's not a prestige type film. So what are you doing?
Although physicality wise.
Well, she actually trained with Terry Bartlett from Cirque du Soleil in preparation for this. So yeah, she put in a lot of work for this. But I think the biggest problem for me with Charlize Theron in this is the script did her no favors whatsoever. Like the dialogue in this, you need to have like, you know, those little, you know, when you walk into a building and they're trying to make sure that they've got the number of people in, they're taking attendance.
Click counter.
Yeah, one of those little click counters. I want to give our listeners a challenge, okay? Go find a copy of Aeon Flux, whether it's on streaming or you go to an actual DVD store and get one and get yourself one of those little click counters. And I want you to hit it every time there's an absolute dialogue cliche in this. And let me know how far into the movie you get before your clicker runs out of numbers. Because there's a few cliches in the dialogue.
Notice he didn't make it a drinking game.
Well, I'm trying to save. You know, it's bad enough that I know that I personally have crutch words. So there are people who are listening to the show, and the minute I say right or something like that, there's take a shot, or the thing is, or, you know, I know, I fully recognize that I have these little verbal mannerisms that come out multiple times in an episode. So if you have turned this into a drinking game, I'm really sorry for your liver. It's not my fault. You chose this life. But that being said, when you think about it, if you're sitting there counting the cliches, then there was a problem with the script to begin with. It should be one of those things where, you know, one or two lines, you know, that are groaners, you sit there and go, oh, okay, you snuck that one in. But if I'm sitting here recommending that you take a click counter and not turn this into a drinking game to save yourself, like, I'm not a writer, but that's bad. But I think the thing is, she actually handled the dialogue that's on the page with about as much skill as she could, right? Because, I mean, come on, I'm sure there's a movie out there, and all of our listeners will agree, there are movies out there where you hear some of the words being said, it's like, wow, some actor went into a table read, read these words aloud, people heard them, and said, yeah, that's the way to go. And then they did it again on set. And then they probably went into the ADR session and did it again. And at no point did they sit there and say, my brain is trying to hurt me as I try to spit these words out in this order. I think part of the problem too here is that the movie should have been a total action fest. But there were a lot of pacing moments, I think, in this film where it relied too heavily on dialogue to drive the plot, right? Give the actors the motivation to do the things that they are doing. And I mean, Carrie, you're in the same boat as me. Our Aeon Flux knowledge isn't there. This is a cool sci-fi-ish movie in a utopian dystopia kind of setting with a, you know, phenomenal actress taking on this role, and it's like, okay, this is an interesting world, but you need the backstory fed to you because it's a new story. I think it's one of those things where a lot of IP property-based films take for granted that you know what you're walking into already. You know, Five Nights at Freddy's. If you didn't know anything about Five Nights at Freddy's and you walk into that film, you're going to be sitting there going, what the is going on, and why am I, you know, when did the drugs enter my body? Because it's starting to hit right now. Think about the Spider-Man films, right? The Tobey Maguire ones, they did the Uncle Ben whole death scene, origin story. But then when you get to the Tom Holland one, we already know Spider-Man's backstory, and Spider-Man is a much more well-known character, let's be honest, right? So did you feel like you needed a lot of the backstory fed to you? And do you feel like you were served enough for that?
I think so. I mean, again, going into this completely new and in the dark, I think when you were talking about that there was too much dialogue, I think the dialogue was necessary.
Well, I didn't say there was too much dialogue. I think the dialogue was cliched. But the thing is, Aeon Flux to me, at least from my limited knowledge of it, feels like it should be a wall-to-wall action type film, but you also need to layer in backstory. But I felt like the pacing for those dialogue moments, you know, there was a lot of standing around and talking for a film that's supposed to have a lot of action in it.
I'm going to disagree.
Okay.
Because the action scenes, like where it kind of turned into a mix of like Big Hero with those little like
the balls and whatnot,
balls of robotic, whatever, almost like
nanite type thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's where I get the Big Hero reference. During those scenes, I didn't know what the hell was going on. Like, without the backstory and without the talking, I think had it been more of like more battle scenes, I would have completely zoned out. I probably would have fallen asleep at that point.
That's you. And yeah, you know, just to give our listeners a little bit of backstory into the wonderfulness that is my lovely wife. We went to go see the first X-Men film in the theaters. And this absolute gem of a human, beautiful lady that she is, fell asleep during the big fight scene on the Statue of freaking Liberty.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, true story. But you know what? I
also fell asleep during a Neil Peart drum solo.
Yes. I thrive on the dialogue. You know, entertain me, inform me, but don't friggin' bore me with the guitar solo. Like, I don't know.
So the action scenes are the guitar and drum solo for you?
Yes. Yes,
okay.
They are.
Okay.
Yeah.
Martin Sakis, who played Trevor Goodchild. So this is like the architect of this utopian society that they live in. Who was he?
He was good at what he did because I still don't quite know after watching it if he was good or bad or...
He's just the target at this point. He's the head of, you know, how this society is run, and yet all these people are disappearing, and yet he seems like it's... There's a lot of questionable, or not questionable, but... questions about people's motives in this and who is really in on what.
Can I say something about his dedication to his past memories?
Yeah.
Is that was a perfect example that love prevails over all, because no matter what she put him through, he still genuinely loved her. He always genuinely loved her.
But here's my question. Okay, so the whole premise of it is that these people are constantly dying and being born again, which seems to be the kind of like the centralness of it, and the reason why they are trying to kill Goodchild is that they think that by stopping him, they'll finally get to stop being, I guess, reborn or respawned or whatever the hell it is, so they can finally rest. The question is, how many times has Trevor himself died, or is he just, you know, ageless and has lived through all those lives? Like,
well, one that we know of.
I mean, the thing is that there are still questions that I have about this film, and I'm not quite sure that everything made sense to me, and I'm a geek.
And I thank you for saying that, because I was just like, I did not study for this exam. I watched it and I have a general idea of what happened, but I still don't quite know what I watched. Does that make sense?
There's the what happened and there's the why it happened. And the what happened, okay, we can tell you exactly what happened, and of course we'd be spoiling the movie for you, but with the why it happened, like, some of it made sense. Some of it was like, okay, I put all this together, that's all fine. But there's a lot of motivations, and there's a few lingering questions that are still, that there are threads that need to be tied up.
Oh, there's great big whys.
Oh, yeah.
All over the place. Yeah.
Yeah. The thing is, I found Martin Sakis to be almost a one-note actor in this. Like, despite all of these things happening to him, and like, you know, his hold on control of this utopian society is at risk. He's trying to be killed by someone who happens to be his ex-wife, in a different life. And yet his tonality stays almost singular through the entire film. Like, at some point, with all that's going on to this guy, you'd think he'd freak the f*** count at least once.
Which makes me wonder if he's an actual person or like a shell of a reincarnation of a person.
I mean, he's a person. They're all people. But I think the thing here is that if he has survived all of these lifetimes, like, you know, like everyone else has had to be respawned, but he didn't have to be, which is kind of like the feeling I'm getting. Maybe he's just become so immune to the everything around him. And keep in mind, too, this society was created, you know, in response to a virus that killed, what was it, 90% of the population, which, you know, apparently it was like in 2015, there was a virus that killed 90% of the population, which...
Yeah. It's not that far off. I mean,
not that funny when you're watching this in 2024, but yeah, no, it's, and then it's 400 years later. So that means he either survived the 400 years or he's died enough times that he retains all the memories and everyone else is in that same situation.
And again, where I say, is he just a shell of his former self?
Yeah,
like, or, at that point, yeah. Like, with every regeneration, he has to lose a little something.
And we know there are modifications that are being done to people in this society, and we'll get to some of those characters a little bit later, but there are so many questions about this guy, and I'm just like, I don't have a full grasp of his backstory, and more to the point, their backstory together. You get that little bit. You know that they were together. You know that they were husband and wife. And is this maybe one of those weird Cloud Atlas things where two people are destined to be together no matter how they look and what life and what era that they're in? Like, there are, I have questions. I have many questions that still to this day. And maybe it's, I need another watch of this film. Maybe I need to subject myself to this again.
That's what I felt when I watched it the first time. And then I was like, no, I'm good. I think I get the gist of what's happening. So, you know.
Yeah. Johnny Lee Miller, who played Trevor's brother, Orrin Goodchild. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, it's funny because I actually felt more connected to his character than to his brother.
Yeah, there was more to Orrin. There
he was more real.
Yeah, he, like an ogre, had layers. You know, like there was some depth to his character. There was a motivation to it. Now, admittedly, like one of the first times we meet Orrin and he's very animated, I'm like, oh, it's going to be one of those really bad overacting type jobs. But as the movie went, his portrayal of Orrin got better throughout the movie. He actually improved as time went on. Interesting, as I'm watching this, and I recognize that the series that I'm about to reference came after this film, and I'm totally going to butcher this name. So I'm going to apologize in advance to Ewan Rayon, who played Maximus in the Inhumans TV series. Now, I get that, you know, Marvel geeks out there, well, the minute I say Inhumans, people are going to go, oh, you went there, didn't you? Maximus's character, very similar how Orrin's relationship to Trevor, Maximus is Black Bolt's brother, and Black Bolt is the king of the Inhumans. But Maximus is trying to overthrow his brother for reasons. Because it's, yeah, I still have yet to watch the entire Inhumans series. It's one of those things where I've been avoiding that one like the plague too. Like, if we ever decided to do It's Not That Bad TV series, Inhumans might have to be at the top of the list. And I would hate myself for having to go through that, you know, again. But the relationship between Maximus and Black Bolt in the Inhumans parallels well with the relationship of Orrin and Trevor in this. I don't see why Johnny Lee Miller was nominated for Worst Supporting Actor at the Stakers. I think he actually did a decent job. Again, his portrayal got better through the film. It started off a little sketchy, a little a touch much. But his conflict with his brother in their difference in ideologies and the scheming that goes on behind the scenes gave texture to the Goodchild connection, to the conflict between the brothers, and that made sense.
You know who I would have loved to have seen play Trevor?
Who?
Colin Farrell. Because his brother came off with like a real thick accent, and then it seemed to have diminished as the movie went on. And I noticed it, and I was like, but I think based on that, I could have seen Colin Farrell play his brother.
Is it bad? Trevor. I could actually picture Colin Farrell as Trevor and Sam Rockwell as Oren.
Ooh.
Yeah, now you're picturing it, aren't you?
Well, I mean, Sam Rockwell could play the shark from Jaws.
Yeah, you went there.
He's my Ben Affleck. I love anything that Sam Rockwell's in, so I'm always going to approve on that one.
I just find it funny that I found the conflict between the brothers more fascinating than the conflict of Aeon Flux trying to kill Trevor Goodchild in order to be able to free society, quote unquote.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a bold statement.
The thing is, the Goodchild brother battling based on ideological differences is a much better story than this overarching... because Aeon Flux is a member of the Monikins or whatever they're called, and they're being used as almost like some kind of SEAL Team 6 to go in there and do these secret missions to help free society. And that was loosely sketched out for me. The Goodchild brother ideological differences to me was the much more solid plot line between the two.
Now, wait a minute. Speaking of siblings, can we talk about Aeon Flux's sister right now?
Amelia Warner, who played Una Flux, yes.
So, if people are getting killed.
Yes.
And regenerating.
Yes.
Did she come back?
Yes, she did.
I missed
that. So there was this scene. Okay, so first of all, let's talk about Una Flux, as played by Amelia Warner. There for a good time, but not for a long time. I really liked Amelia Warner as Una Flux. In her role, and she was very sweet in the role too, but in that role, she humanizes Aeon Flux, who is this badass freaking killing machine.
Okay, but was it a flashback or she actually came back?
No, so she came back, but she was basically reborn. So there was this scene where Aeon and Trevor are in this house and they find the baby and she recognizes Una's eyes in the baby and puts two and two together. So she sees the rebirth of people. And this is why she's trying to kill Trevor Goodchild, in hopes of stopping the rebirth so that people can finally rest and not live lives over and over and over again with the memories of hundreds of past lives.
Okay, so yes, you're right. And I did forget that, but she never resurfaced as her adult form.
No, as Amelia Warner, no.
So the shot that was a flashback.
No, it wasn't a flashback scene. So we met Aeon Flux as she's about to do this mission in order to be able to stop this Minority Report style water dripping thing where the Goodchild regime has the ability to witness everything. But while she's doing that mission, they figure out who's doing it. So they kill Una Flux as a warning, a shot across the bow towards Aeon. So, and then she discovers Una has been reborn. There's this baby. That's the whole works. So again, there are some confusing plot lines and it does take a little bit of red string theory in order to be able to wrap your head around everything. But I think Amelia Warner did a good job for the time that she was there. Sophie Okonedo, who played Sithandra, the girl with feet for hands, and also another member of the Monikins. How was Sophie for you?
I mean, definitely incredibly physically talented.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that had to have been hard to pull off. And obviously it was done with, you know, digital.
Yeah, so they digitally inserted the hands for feet. But I think the interesting thing here with what Sophie Okonedo did with Sithandra is that it actually changes the fighting style of how someone would fight. And I think, you know, you say physical, and yes, absolutely. Sophie Okonedo brought it in those scenes because you have to rethink your entire, like, how would you fight someone if you had four hands?
Well, again, that's exactly it. Like, her movement style was so perfect. Like, it was so incredibly well done that made it believable, even though obviously not. But
And I don't want to sit here and dump on the CGI because, you know, not all the shots were 100% perfect when getting the, you know, the hands for feet kind of thing. I'm not a digital artist. I could never do that. I'm not that freaking talented. So, you know, kudos for those who tried it. But the thing here too is that Sathandra actually had a full character arc, as opposed to everyone who kind of sat in the same pocket, because she was assigned to Aeon to help her get into the facility. And you could see there's almost like this, you know, co-worker rivalry where it's like, yeah, we're going to help each other out, but really I'm also going to, you know, give you the gears kind of thing. And then of course, Sathandra is sicked onto Aeon once it's discovered that Aeon has gone against the mission parameters. And then Sathandra then comes around and helps Aeon Flux. Like, there's a lot to Sathandra that actually cements Aeon's role with the Monikans. And in seeing that full arc, I think Sathandra actually had, again, how is it I like the side characters more than the main character? That's not a good thing if you're writing a sci-fi film and everything is centered. Like, the person whose name is the title of the film should be the most interesting person in the film. And as much as I like Charlize Theron as an actor, not the most interesting character.
Not necessarily true with Kill Bill, because Bill wasn't the most interesting character.
Okay, I'm going to argue that one, though, okay? In Kill Bill, the title is more of a mission statement for the bride. The movie is called Aeon Flux. Charlize Theron's character is Aeon Flux.
It's kind of like, okay, Harry Potter. Maybe
it should have been Hermione Granger.
It should have been, yeah.
Because let's be honest, ain't getting done if it's up to Harry.
They would have not made it out of first year of Hogwarts.
Pretty much. They would have walked out with like a slimy, snot-covered, half-assed broken wand, a demolished chess set. Whew. And Hermione's sitting there going, they shouldn't have listened to me. Leviosa. Yeah, I went there, didn't I?
Yeah.
Caroline Chakasi, who played Freya, who was working with the good childs, like Trevor's assistants, but also conspiring with Orm, but also kind of triple agenting and reporting back to Trevor. How was she for you?
She played her part well because, I mean, obviously, you couldn't trust her. She was a double, triple agent. I think it would have made it more interesting if she was maybe more on the side of Aeon Flux as well.
Okay, I'm just going to read what I wrote down here, because this is going to identify exactly why this plot is a little bit on the dizzying side, okay? She's working for Trevor, but conspiring with Orin, but really double agenting for Trevor, but fighting Aeon, who tries to kill Trevor, but can't, and Freya knows this, but still tries to kill Aeon. Like, I'm dizzy reading that.
True, but again, it would have thrown a really interesting wrench in the plans if she was maybe not necessarily trying to help Aeon, but helping feet for hands for
Sathandra.
Feet. Yes, helping her.
I think this is why the good child sibling conflict is the better story in this, and not Aeon Flux's mission. Because again, this is one of those layers. Freya is one of those layers that helps develop the tension between the good childs and the machinations between this, you know, familial brother power hierarchy. This is the story to me. Not Aeon Flux trying to kill Trevor, free society. It's the good child power imbalance. And this almost Game of Thrones style power play between the two. Like, that's the better angle. But again, that's just me. A couple more actors to talk about here. Again, a small role, Pete Postlethwaite as the Keeper, or as Carrie would know him as, creepy old guy in a blimp over Utopia. As I have said that, Carrie has this look of, the f*** are you talking about?
Oh, yep.
So let me pseudo. So there's this blimp over this utopian society with some old creeper guy in his pajamas walking around, his pajama robes. And he happens to be the guy that happens to know about all the rebirth and all. Like, the problem here is that there is absolutely zero backstory context to this, except for like one little flashback scene. I'm like, okay, cool. Why do you matter? It was like one of those, we need some creepy old guy in the blimp.
I'm not going to lie. I completely forgot about him. what are you fucking talking about?
But that's the thing. This should have been some bigger part of the revelation. But this is why the main Aeon Flux, like the A plot, is inferior to the B plot. That's not good. And when you have someone of Pete Postlethwaite's, you know, credentials and his acting resume, and you stick him up in a blimp and you show him for a few minutes, and then people are still going, cool, okay. By the way, who's the creepy guy in the blimp? I still don't know. That's not good. Then we get to the second Oscar winner in this film, Frances McDormand, who's the handler, or as you would know, creepy old woman in Aeon Flux's mind telling her to do things. Frances McDormand for you.
I mean, I just thought they were the sounds of her thoughts.
Yeah, okay, so
the voice in her head.
Let me diatribe here. Because again, sci-fi geek talking here. I have questions. So Aeon Flux only communicates with the handler when, like, she's in, like, some, like, almost otherworldly trance. And I get that people are modified and whatnot. But I don't know if the handler is real, if it's a real person, and they're communicating through telepathy. I don't know if it's some kind of AI that's in a program because it kind of comes through, like, cybernetic implants. Like, I still have questions about the handler. I have more questions about the handler than I do about the creepy old guy up in the blimp. And you have an Oscar winner in that role? And Frances McDormand, like, gem of an actress, but they did not give her much to work. Stand behind the podium, talk monotonously, and don't do anything else. Come in, stand here, and read for a while. That's about it. That is like Christopher Lee getting like two lines in a film, but you got Christopher Lee in your film. I mean, I get it, but I don't. That you have a perfectly phenomenal actress and a waste of her. Now, I get the feeling. That there was more to the handler and probably more to Pete Postlethwaite's character in the apparently longer director's version, which is like 30 minutes longer. There's a lot of plot here that needs to be fleshed out for me. Maybe it's just me. Like, I don't know. Do you feel like you had a grasp on everything? Or are you sitting there going, I still don't know what the hell went on?
Yes.
So, I mean, like, the potential is there. And I think the IP has merit in, you know, and enough of a backstory that could be. Now, apparently this film also deviates greatly from the animated series. So there's probably another knock on the critic score where it's like, okay, cool, you're going to take an IP, but then you're going to ignore what the IP did. That's not necessarily cool. Aeon Flux could be done right, I think, if you have someone who knows the IP. I have no problem with Charlize Theron if she were to come back in a new Aeon Flux film. She could still do it. She's that awesome. I think this could work better as a series. Because then you have time to build the world. You cut this down to a short, you know, happy 2005 movie length, and you don't have the breathing space to tell the full story.
So do you think that extra half hour would have changed your opinion?
I think it would have. I think it would have depended on what was in the half an hour. Like, if it was just a half an hour of more mindless side plots or anything, then no. But
if it were more action, less dialogue?
I think if it was more, if it flushed out Aeon's story more. Again, to me, the B plot's the far superior plot. All right, but enough about saying over which story is better. The only story that we need to know, Carrie, who is your MVP of Aeon Flux?
Well, with all that said, I don't know. I'm second guessing myself, but I am going to go with Charlize Theron. I thought she was great.
Oh, I mean, she was. She was good. To me, the script did her no favors whatsoever, and I think the plot, at least the plot development, didn't do her any favors, but that's not on Charlize Theron at all.
She was quite likable.
Oh, absolutely. To me, though, Sithandra is my MVP, Sophie Okonedo. Again, this is the one character that got a full arc for me that made me actually like the character and then hate the character and then like the character again and made the most sense. So kudos to Sophie Okonedo and really anyone who puts, you know, work into these films. Because, I mean, just because we're sitting there going, I don't know what the hell's going on and maybe it's not hitting right with us, but that doesn't make it a bad film. Nothing that anyone says on a podcast means jack squat in the real world. So I know, right? Like, it's then why do we keep talking for year after year on these podcasts? Why? Because we like it. We like it. We like watching bad movies. So that's just us. But don't ever sit there and say, well, this podcast said it was a bad film, so I say it's a bad film. I say it's an incomplete film. Property could be good. People still did a good job. Go watch Aeon Flux and decide for yourself. Carrie, thank you so much for this. And to you, our listeners, you guys know the drill. If there is a movie out there that you think is unfairly maligned or is just so bad that there is no way in utopia that we can find anything good to say about it, hit us up on social media at NotThatBadCast or go to our website at NotThatBadCast.com. And while you're there, go check out our coming soon page so you can see some of the episodes that we are working on. Until next time, she's Carrie, I'm Jay. You guys are awesome. This is It's Not That Bad, a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Take care.